Trump's temperament, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Donald Trump dismisses the 50 Republican national security experts who say he is not fit to be president. He says they're just Washington elite trying to hold on to power. One of the 50 responds,
I'm not trying to hold on to any power. I'm concerned about how power is exercised in the Oval Office, and I don't think he has the judgment, the character, and the temperament to be the person who's holding the reins of power in our country.
And later, some see synthetic diamonds as the solution to the problem of blood diamonds mined in Africa. Others disagree.
So the solution isn't to say, you 1.5 million diggers and the 7 million people you're supporting, all of you go to hell, we're going to sell synthetic diamonds.
Those stories, plus Russians in Rio, today on The World. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump dismisses them as members of the failed Washington elite. But it's hard for anyone to ignore the 50 Republicans, all former national security officials, who signed an open letter this week saying Trump is not qualified to be president and commander-in-chief. Jendai Fraser is one of those who signed the letter. Fraser is a former assistant secretary of state for Africa and was also special assistant to President Bush on African affairs. Jendai Fraser, what's in the letter?
Well, the letter basically calls into question his character, specifically looking at his inability to really deal with disagreement. The fact that he spends most of his time putting down those who do not agree with him, that he's very thin-skinned. It also calls into question, you know, his values and whether he has the experience to be the president of the United States. The issue here is that, you know, Mr. Trump is asking us to put all of the power of our country in his hands, but yet he doesn't seem to have the type of temperament that would allow him to exercise that power with restraint.
Where does this leave you? You're a Republican and he's your candidate.
Well, he's my party's candidate. And so where it leaves me most importantly is to say to my party, enough. You know, we lost the last election with Romney, who was a decent candidate, a very good candidate. But we felt at that time that we needed to open up the party and build a bigger tent. Now we have a candidate at the head of our ticket who is doing the opposite of what we all assess to be the necessary next move for the Republican Party to be competitive. And so it leaves me with saying to my party, we have a moral obligation to stand up against this type of candidate who's dividing the nation rather than bringing the nation together. And let's take a stance now.
It's amazing to see someone of your stature having to take this stand. Do you think the Republican Party can survive this level of public divisiveness?
Well, that's the point, is to make sure that the Republican Party survives beyond this election and survives as a recognizable party. Doesn't matter for people to hijack our party and continue to use a name if they're not standing by the values that party has reflected since its beginning with Abraham Lincoln.
Given how many foreign policy experts Trump has alienated, who's left to fill those top positions if there were a Trump administration?
Well, I'm sure that he'll find someone. You know, I'm sure. And it'll be a very, very likely to be a very inexperienced administration. And, you know, our country will have to adjust if he should win. And if they're the advisors, they'll have to learn on a job.
Now, Donald Trump has responded. The signatories of the letter, he said, were the ones the American people should look to for answers on why the world is a mess. And we thank them for coming forward so everyone in the country knows who deserves the blame for making the world such a dangerous place. He called you all nothing more than the failed Washington elite looking to hold on to their power. Jendai Fraser, do you care to comment?
Well, I don't think that I'm Washington elite. I definitely think that any administration has many crises that they're going to have to manage. And the question is about how do you manage it? And so, you know, Donald Trump typically does what he's doing right there, which is to personalize, denigrate, you know, and push back without clear deliberation. He doesn't seem capable of actually listening to what people are saying. And so to me, I feel even more, you know, more convinced and committed to trying to say to the Republican Party and to the nation as a whole, this guy doesn't have the temperament to lead our country, and we need to rethink this. And I definitely will not be voting for Donald Trump. I'm not trying to hold on to any power. I'm concerned about how power is exercised in the Oval Office, and I don't think he has the judgment, the character, and the temperament to be the person who's holding the reins of power in our country.
Former Assistant Secretary of State Jendai Fraser is one of the 50 top Republican national security experts who signed an open letter regarding Donald Trump's lack of fitness for the office of President and Commander-in-Chief. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Let's turn now to one foreign policy expert who takes a different view on Donald Trump's ideas regarding America's place on the world stage.
Trump has occasionally, in his three sensible moments, suggested an alternative way of thinking about American interests and how American power is used, that if he stuck to those, we might be having a fairly interesting discussion.
That's Harvard's Stephen Walt. In a new article in Foreign Policy, Walt describes the three sensible concepts he sees woven into Trump's worldview.
The idea that American foreign policy should first and foremost serve the American national interest is not beyond the pale at all.
Sure.
Second, he argues that American allies, particularly our wealthy allies in Europe and some in Asia, are free riding on American protection, that we pay a disproportionate share of global security burdens. He's correct in that regard. The percentage of GDP devoted to defense is substantially larger than that of our wealthy European allies. And of course, Barack Obama has complained about this. And then finally, he's been skeptical of sort of nation building in far-flung corners of the world. So those three fairly sensible things are not particularly controversial. And if he stuck with those, we might actually be having a quite constructive and useful debate between Clinton and Trump about what America's role in the world ought to be.
Even if he's criticizing nation-building efforts and claiming to be opposed to dumb wars, his rhetoric at least seems incredibly trigger-happy and warmongerish.
Absolutely. And his instinct to sort of immediately go after opponents and insult them in the most demeaning ways, I think, is contrary to the normal way that diplomacy is conducted and the way that diplomacy is successfully conducted.
I think all of us struggle with what the moment means, what the rhetoric means, what our responsibilities are, personal and political, to this presidential race. From your position, are these things that will lead to, could they lead to robust debates about foreign policy? Could his provocative comments help us see our nuclear dilemmas anew? Could provocative comments about Putin help us shape a new foreign policy? Is there something useful here, or should we only be frightened?
Well, I think we should mostly be frightened or concerned. And I think it's unfortunate because there is a serious debate to be had now about how extensively the United States should be involved around the world, where our vital interests really are. Should the United States be taking on responsibility for providing security in Europe, in much of the Middle East, and in Asia all simultaneously? What role should we be playing nation building or dealing with organizations like Boko Haram in Africa or ISIS in the Middle East? That's a serious set of issues. And what worries me is that because that sensible view is also associated with his tendency to engage in racist rhetoric, his weird ideas about international trade, his cavalier remarks about nuclear weapons, that sensible alternative that he occasionally gets close to is going to be unfairly discredited by its association with a candidate who really is in many ways beyond the pale.
If you step back from the Trump drama for a second, are you worried about anything that neither candidate will address?
That's a great question. I think the biggest thing that worries me, I suppose, is not so much the array of challenges that we see out there in the world, whether it's slow growth economy worldwide now, environmental problems, climate change, the problem of violent extremism, and a series of other concerns that one could point to. That list is a pretty obvious list. I think what worries me most is the growing incapacity of many political institutions, both here in the United States but also in other countries, to address those problems. We know the problems are there. but we don't seem to be particularly good at devising effective solutions to it. And that, of course, makes people begin to contemplate wilder alternatives. You know, the system is broken. Well, maybe I'll just throw all my trust in this guy who claims he can fix it. And I was both struck by but also worried by Trump's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention, which did have certain echoes of what I think of as sort of the classic authoritarian, classic fascist appeal. This idea that, you know, enemies are everywhere, that things are getting worse, the danger is growing, that our political opponents are really treasonous. They've betrayed us. They're not to be trusted. And then the real kicker is, I alone can save you. I am your voice. You know, this is what Mussolini, this is what other authoritarian leaders have always done.
Stephen Walt of Harvard University and Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you very much for talking to us about this.
Pleasure talking with you.
Okay, time for an Olympic breather here. It's one of the great things about the Games. They give us a chance to put the news on hold for a while and just watch some of the world's best athletes perform amazing feats. But for Russian fans in Rio to cheer their team on, it's more complicated. We sent the world's Will Carlos to check in with some of them.
Russia House is the base for Russian fans and officials at the Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. And last night, people here cheered as they watched two Russian bronze medalists walk onto the stage waving. It was quite a difference from the reception Russian swimmer Yulia Efimova got on Sunday. She was booed at Rio's aquatic center as she took her place for a heat for the 100-meter breaststroke. Efimova is one of several Russian athletes competing in Rio under a cloud of suspicion. She previously served a 16-month suspension for doping. Last month, an independent investigation concluded that Russia has been running a state-sponsored doping program. The country was nearly banned entirely from the Rio Games, but the International Olympic Committee decided against a blanket ban just a few days before the opening ceremony. For Russian fans like Maxim Zhan, it's been a tough time.
All this news, it's very sad, actually. Yeah.
Max lives in Rio, and he's long looked forward to the day the Olympics come to town. Back in Siberia, his dad was a gym teacher, and Max grew up watching the Olympics. He doesn't believe the allegations against Russia are true. He thinks it's probably a big conspiracy to cast Russia as the bad guys of the Olympics.
They were kind of scared that Russia will, all the team will participate in the Olympic Games and we again will won like many medals. So I don't know, maybe they were just making some stories, like exaggerating in something.
It's a theory I hear again and again at Russia House. In about a dozen interviews, not one person tells me they believe the doping scandal is real. But even with a cloud hanging over their national team, Russian visitors like Anna Kakosha from Siberia say everyone in Brazil has been friendly.
Smile, amazing, very interesting what city. When we said it's Siberia, she, whoa!
One man here, who wouldn't give his name, says he walked the length of Copacabana Beach over the weekend, draped in a Russian flag. And he said lots of people offered support for the Russian team over the doping allegations.
And all people came to me from different countries and told me that we know who is standing behind this scandal.
And by that he means the US. He and other Russians here say Russia has long been painted by the American media as the Olympic heavies. And this doping scandal is just the latest piece of anti-Russian propaganda. But just as quickly, the Russians here stress that the feeling is not mutual. They've got no beef with Americans, several people tell me. This is just politics, and the Olympics shouldn't be about politics, says 21-year-old Andrei Polinov.
America, my friends. My friends and my minus brothers. Маленький брат.
America is like my little brother, he says. For the world, Will Carlos, Rio de Janeiro.
A push to replace blood diamonds with stones created in the lab, that story ahead on The World. Manufactured diamonds have been around for decades, but the stones coming out of the lab were long seen as inferior to their natural counterparts, the top-quality diamonds mined out of the ground. Yet in the past few years, man-made diamonds have started to give real diamonds a run for their money, and that has the diamond industry bracing for a fight. Here's Alina Simone with our story.
Silicon Valley is a playground of sci-fi wonders. Driverless cars, virtual reality arcades, the robots that will soon replace your dog. I'm here to check out the latest, a diamond mine the size of a passenger van that can be controlled with an iPhone.
This is our unit foundry. It's the prototype foundry for the future. It includes our growth reactors in which we hot forge diamond under the heat of a plasma.
Martin Rusheisen is the CEO and founder of the Diamond Foundry, the man-made diamond industry's hottest new startup.
And how long does it take to make a batch?
It takes about 2 weeks to make one batch.
Compare that to the 1 billion-plus years for the Earth to produce a diamond, and you get why the traditional diamond industry is up in arms.
Diamonds are forever.
In 1947, De Beers coined the phrase, "Diamonds are forever," redefining the diamond as the ultimate symbol of romance, timeless, rare, and worth considerable financial pain. Today, companies like the Diamond Foundry want to convince consumers that a diamond is forever, even if it was born yesterday. Their pitch is based on ethics. The struggle to control Africa's diamond market has fueled 4 civil wars, leaving millions dead, disfigured, and displaced. It's a human tragedy that became a cause célèbre with the 2006 movie Blood Diamond.
It came from the heart of the earth. A stone so rare, men will do anything to possess it. All who touch it are left with blood on their hands.
Leonardo DiCaprio, who starred in the film, is a prominent investor in the Diamond Foundry, along with 10 tech billionaires who believe technology will one day replace the world's diamond mines and the environmental and human rights abuses that come with them. So who wouldn't be seduced by that kind of future?
Leonardo DiCaprio is a rabbi taking ham sandwiches and telling everybody they're kosher. What he's doing is fundamentally ethically wrong.
Meet another Martin, Martin Rappaport, founder of the largest diamond trading network in the world. Like most leaders in the industry, he sees lab-grown diamonds as a threat, not a solution. Rappaport says buying a man-made stone will do nothing to help impoverished diggers in Africa.
The solution isn't to say, hey, you 1.5 million diggers and the 7 million people you're supporting, all of you go to hell, we're going to sell synthetic diamonds.
He says the solution is to say to diamond mining companies, we'll pay you a premium if you stop using child labor. Basically, a fair trade diamond.
How do you do bananas? How do you do cocoa? How do you do any other fair trade product?
A skeptic might dismiss these justifications as an old world industry just trying to protect its bottom line. But for Rappaport, at least, it's personal. 7 years before the movie Blood Diamond hit the screens, he was touring amputee camps in Sierra Leone.
Thousands of people, an arm, a leg, an arm and a leg, little children. This person held up this little baby and said, you know, tell them what happened to us. And you have to understand, like my parents, they were in Auschwitz. And so I saw this. I said, what the hell is this? This cannot happen.
Rappaport has poured a lot of time and money into creating a fair trade system.
It's very difficult, but Development Diamond Initiative is working on it. We're working on it. Other people working on it.
But a diamond's journey involves a long, complicated, and easily corruptible supply chain. Rappaport admits a fair trade stone is still a long way off.
Diamonds are forever.
Throw your diamonds in the sky if you feel the vibe.
Africa's diamond-producing nations themselves are also worried about the impact of techno-diamonds. Botswana receives 40% of its government revenue from diamonds. But when I asked Martin Rusheisen whether the switch to man-made diamonds might end up hurting diamond diggers in countries like Botswana, he didn't buy it.
It's a little bit of twisted logic because that also would justify releasing the Mexican drug dealers out of jail. You know, after all, they employ a lot of people.
The march of technological progress, he believes, is unstoppable. And with that, Rush Eisen excused himself. FedEx had just arrived with a custom man-made diamond ring for his girlfriend, mined in California. For The World, this is Alina Simone from Silicon Valley.
Let's test your memory now. I'm going to take you back 20 years. Do you remember where the Olympics took place in 1996? Yep, Atlanta, Georgia. One athlete who could never forget those games, Chioma Adjunwa, the long jumper, became the first Nigerian ever in Olympic history to win an individual gold medal. Our colleagues at the BBC caught up with her recently. She's now a policewoman in Lagos, but she still remembers entering the Olympic Stadium in Atlanta for her event.
You know, when I came out, I saw all the professional athletes. They were jogging, and I happened to be the smallest among them. As they were jogging in and out, something struck my brain and said, look, get up. Their legs are not made of iron. They are human beings like you. And by the time they call us for the long jump finals, my mind was like a stone. I was not afraid any longer. My name is Chioma Adjunwa Opara, the first Nigerian individual Olympic gold medalist. I am a policewoman. I work with Nigerian Police Force. Here is Police College Ikeja. Let's go. When we came back here in Nigeria, it was overwhelming. You know, when they asked me, our chief coach, Emilia Edect, asked me to be in front, I came, I saw the crowd, I ran inside the flight. And I was like, what is this? The crowd is so much. They said yes, because the president of Nigeria has given 3 days public holiday for us. And since then, my life never remained the same. I'm so grateful to God, because left for man wouldn't have been me. They must have chosen somebody from a better home, from a rich home, but God being whom he is, he did it for me. Here in Nigeria, we don't have the attitude of, you know, going into planning. We don't take it serious. It's not that we don't have talent. It's not that we can't have the likes of Usain Bolt. We can have them up to 10, 20, because we have great talent here in the country. But our problem is we don't want to go to the grassroots. We don't want to spend money on the athletes. We don't want to give them the platform where they could start from.
Chioma Adjunwa speaking to the BBC. She won Nigeria's first individual gold medal ever at the Atlanta Olympics back in 1996. There's more Olympic coverage coming up later in the show. We'll take a look at the original formula for getting a leg up on the competition, strychnine and alcohol. And we'll try to find out what happened to Romania's once powerful women's gymnastics team. You're listening to The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Doping in sports is nothing new. Back in the day, athletes got a boost by using things like strychnine.
We think of strychnine today as a rat killer in small doses. It can have a stimulating effect, and it was pretty commonly used.
The dirty history of doping in sports. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. 3 years ago, photographer Misha Friedman traveled to South Africa. He went to Guguletu, a township near Cape Town, to photograph several women living with HIV and tuberculosis. This year, he went back to try to find the women again. He found out some of them had died since his first visit. Friedman has now produced a new portrait series focusing in part on those who were left behind and on the ongoing HIV crisis in South Africa, a country with the highest infection rate in the world. I asked him why he decided to go back.
Because that's not the type of work that's usually done by journalists, especially visiting journalists. Usually you just go, you find your subjects, you spend time with them as much as you need or you can, or what you can afford. You do your study and you move on. And I had this opportunity to go back to South Africa. So instead of just going to the conference, I felt that it would be interesting to try to see what actually happens to real people, because quite often, you know, we end up talking about how it's about raising awareness, it's about helping future generations, but the work itself really does very little for the people that you've documented. So the only way to do it is to actually personally revisiting them.
So what was it like to go back?
It wasn't easy because I didn't know what I would find, and some people I was not able to find. Sadly, two of the women I documented 3 years ago have died since. But for all the cases, what I tried to do was I tried to speak or find the relatives or people who were also in the photographs back then and just get their story right. The women who have died, have all died of tuberculosis, which is the leading morbidity for people with HIV.
There's one portrait of a young man alone in a small room, and his mother was one of the people who died. Who is he and how is he doing?
His name is Sepisi. He's 15 years old. When I first met him, I mean, it was one of the most strangest and most horrific things I've ever seen in all my years photographing tuberculosis and HIV, is that his mother was in pretty good shape, living in this shack, but she was sharing a bed with, at the time, a 12-year-old and a 4-year-old daughter. I mean, she didn't just have tuberculosis. She had multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, also highly contagious and very tough to treat part of tuberculosis. And they were all not just sharing a house, but sharing a bed. So when I met them again, it turned out that she passed away a few months after I first met them, and the biological father of the younger sister came and took her to live with him, but left the boy behind. So he was by himself, completely alone, and it was just subsiding on kind of goodwill of the neighbors. So that was tough.
You photograph people with HIV all over the world, and I wonder what's different about South Africa, if there is something that's different.
I think the contrast between the haves and the have-nots, Cape Town is a really strange place. You know, I've worked and lived in South Sudan and Uganda and Northern Uganda, and you see some pretty bad things, but then you don't have Michelin-starred restaurants, short cab ride away, and world-class galleries and incredible beaches and scenery and all that stuff. But in Cape Town, between a world-class airport that was built for the World Cup just a few years ago and like the high life of Cape Town, you have hundreds of thousands of people living in absolute hopeless conditions. And that's really tough.
Photographer Misha Friedman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can see photos from Misha Friedman's most recent trip to South Africa, including the portrait of the boy who lost his mother to HIV and tuberculosis and now lives alone. That's at PRI.org. Our next story takes us to China. When HIV first emerged there decades ago, it was largely transmitted through blood transfusions. China managed to contain that epidemic. Now the country is facing a rising HIV infection rate among gay men. They accounted for about 28% of all new HIV infections in China last year. We have a profile now of one man who's part of that statistic. Our story was reported by Larry Zhou and is told here by Ted Anderson.
Maitian lives in Chengdu with his wife. That's not his real name. He can't use his real name because he's gay and HIV positive.
I was married in 1995. Right before I got married, I started exploring my sexual identity.
Maitian is 47 now. and he's been married for 20 years. That's not unusual for gay men and women in China. Maitian says he always expected to marry a woman and raise a child, and living with a man was out of the question for him.
I think that is only for the privileged. We're just common people. Our parents and our siblings are very concerned about how we lead our family lives.
And when Maitian got married in 1995, being gay was punishable under the crime of hooliganism. That changed 2 years later, and in 2001, homosexuality was removed from the list of mental illnesses in China. These days, there are young gay Chinese who live openly in big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, but they're still a small minority. For Maitian, it wasn't an option. He stayed in his traditional marriage but continued to meet up with men. He says he was a regular at gay bathhouses in Chengdu, where he had unprotected sex.
I thought I got what I wanted. My body feels good, and it didn't cost much.
In 2009, Maitian went in for some minor surgery at a local hospital, which required an HIV test, and he tested positive. Then local health officials pressed him to bring his wife to be tested. She was also HIV positive. Maitian is sure he gave her the virus, but his wife probably doesn't know that.
I shifted the blame to her. Our son was born in 1997 via C-section, and she had to have a blood transfusion. I said it must be from that incident, and she believed it.
Maitian said his wife nearly broke down when she learned she had HIV, and there were moments when she questioned the whole blood transfusion theory.
She said, why did our son test negative for HIV? I said our son was not breastfed. Our son grew up on formula milk.
Maitian says over the years, his wife has more or less accepted the transfusion explanation. And she never really asked him again how they both became infected. The Chinese government provides free antiretroviral drugs. Maitian and his wife are both on medication now and relatively healthy, but it hasn't been easy.
HIV is not like other diseases. It's a lifetime disease. It takes a great toll on our bodies. I feel very guilty for my family and for my wife. As much as I can, I think I should do more for my family and for her.
But Maitian says he has no plan to tell his wife he's gay. For The World, I'm Ted Anderson.
Teenage Olympian Lily King became the face of clean competition last night. The American swimmer won the gold in the 100-meter breaststroke. And after her victory, King said she felt, quote, incredible, winning the gold and knowing I did it clean. Those words were aimed at her main rival, Russian Yulia Efimova. She recently served a doping suspension. Just one example of how performance-enhancing drugs are once again a big topic at the Olympics. We wanted to find out when it all started, so we asked Mark Johnson, author of Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sports.
It really started with professional sports, which rose with the Industrial Revolution, because once you had enough people piling into big cities, that created demand for entertainment, and promoters started charging admittance for bicycle races at velodromes, like at Madison Square Garden, and soccer leagues started up in Europe. And really taking pharmaceuticals and chemicals to ply your craft, whether it be as a professional cyclist, a runner, or a walker, was really part of the trade. And it really wasn't frowned upon or stigmatized for roughly the first 100 years of professional organized sports.
What are examples? What kind of chemicals?
Probably the best example or the most interesting example is a guy named Charles Hicks, who won the 1904 Olympic marathon. He was a British runner racing for the American team, and he won the marathon in St. Louis with the assistance of strychnine and alcohol. Although we think of strychnine today as a rat killer, in small doses, it can have a stimulating effect, and it was pretty commonly used. And it was not seen as something that was a sign of moral failing, but in fact, it was celebrated as the fact that this British American could turn to modern technology in order to push the boundaries of human performance.
Strychnine and alcohol, that just sounds horrendous. How did he take it?
He would give them small dosages orally, and then they would also take brandy. And at the time, drinking water was frowned upon. So alcohol, whether it be beer or brandy, was really the go-to fluid.
So I just want to ask you more examples. That's so bizarre. Is there another striking one, a different sport, a different chemical?
Well, the amphetamines first became commercially available in 1937, and they really became the go-to drug for cyclists because there's not a lot of evidence that suggests that amphetamines have a performance-enhancing effect, but they make you feel stronger, more ambitious, and more courageous. And so they really became a drug that cyclists and endurance athletes turned to in order to get them through some really horrendous days.
And so, Mark, did anything go in that period?
Yeah, I mean, it was a much less paternalistic approach. These were, you know, athletes were considered professionals, and if they needed to put drugs in their body to win and make a buck, then it was really their responsibility to keep themselves healthy and know the limits of drugs.
Mark, just to wrap up, what can what you've learned about the history of doping teach us about our present dilemmas?
I think one way to reconfigure how we perceive doping is to not look at doping as a new cancer that has infected sport and is ruining the spirit of sport. The spirit of Olympic and professional sports is to push the boundaries of human performance, and enlisting technology has always been part of that effort. And so drugs have always been part of that effort up till today. But it was our attitudes towards doping changed in the 60s. And so in the 60s, this sort of a missionary effort took root to try and cleanse sport of this deeply traditional doping practice. So the traumas that we see today with the Russians, for instance, is the continued struggle to impose a very alien set of traditions on sport. Is it possible? Perhaps. I mean, it's particularly difficult for Americans where we advertise performance-enhancing drugs on television like Viagra. We send very mixed messages. We say doping is fine, whether it be Viagra, Adderall, to perform better in life, to do better at school, to do better at work. But then we hold athletes up to a completely different set of standards, which is very contrary to the message that we send to everyone else who's not an athlete.
Mark Johnson is the author of Spitting in the Soup, Inside the Dirty Game of Doping in Sports. Thanks for talking to us about all this.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me on.
More stories ahead on The World, but first a preview of a story you'll hear on the show tomorrow. Block Island is an hour off the New England coast by ferry boat. Tourists come for the surf and the sand, and this year to see some structures being built offshore.
People have been, since last summer, coming up here to see this. As much as there are people who don't want to see them, there are people coming here to see them.
What they're seeing is the first offshore wind farm in America. An engineer from the Netherlands is building it. He says some of his neighbors are not happy about it, and they don't hold back.
They have no problem telling me that it's a stupid project and it should never happen. But that's only 10% of the people.
Others look forward to the completion of America's first offshore wind farm. We'll have more on that story tomorrow. I'm Jeb Sharp with The World.
And 10 has gone on the board. That's perfection. And that is Olympic history for Nadia Comăneci.
Romania's Nadia Comăneci scoring the first perfect 10 in an Olympic gymnastics event back in 1976. By contrast, this year in Rio, Romania doesn't even have a team in women's gymnastics, just one individual gymnast. I asked Devorah Myers what happened in between. She's the author of The End of the Perfect 10.
If you pay attention to gymnastics during the intervening years between Olympics, what was becoming really clear over the last 8 years is that the Romanian gymnastics program was on the decline. And so sometimes they were able to rally for the Olympics like they did in London, but they weren't winning that many medals. They weren't placing very high. And you were just seeing them really struggle to bring up a new generation of gymnasts the way they once did. Like every few years you saw a new Romanian star. Now they were relying on gymnasts who debuted in London, and those were the core of the team still in 2016.
Tell us about Catalina Panor, who was basically dragged out of retirement, it sounds like, to compete in Rio.
Exactly. She was essentially dragged out of retirement. She was a member of the last gold medal winning team they had, which was the 2004 team in Athens. She was also came out of retirement for London as well. So this points to how amazing she is, that she can keep coming out of retirement and she still is a medal contender. But on the other hand, it kind of shows how weak the Romanian program is, that they are still relying on their star from an Olympics that was more than 10 years ago.
What really piqued your interest about this story and what struck you about the team and the sport as you dug into it?
I grew up with Romania being a really strong program. So I think for a lot of us who sort of came of age as gymnasts, watching Romania, I mean, I came of age in the 90s, but that was like during the start of their winning streak. And then just seeing this like steep, steep decline, I just remember being at the World Championships in 2014, where they had such a catastrophic performance in the preliminary round that they almost didn't make it into team finals. And I was sitting next to a friend who was around the same age, and we were both looking at each other like, what is going on here? So I think that my interest in it is, you know, both an interest in gymnastics and an interest in answering the question of what is going on here.
If there's one thing that really contributes to this decline, what would you say it is?
I would say it's economic. It's not a flashy answer. It's not a sexy answer. But gymnastics is a resource-intensive sport. The countries, for the most part, that have been most successful at it have resources. And Romania has been poor, and it's been poor for a long time. And they don't contribute the same level of money to sport in the country as they once did.
Yeah, and if we looked at it a different way, it would actually be extraordinary if they did have a top gymnastics team.
And it was extraordinary that for the longest time they did. They didn't have as many gymnasts. The United States has so many gymnasts in the pipeline. So if some juniors, you know, some promising juniors don't make the transition to the senior level the way you would hope, it's not a tragedy because you have, you know, 10 more right behind them who are going to, you know, do better maybe than you thought they were going to or going to meet your expectations. But in Romania, if their promising juniors don't make the transition to the senior level the way that they had hoped, they have no replacements for those girls. Because in gymnastics, people do get injured, and so you're only as good as your bench.
Devorah Myers is a journalist in Brooklyn. She's the author of the book, The End of the Perfect 10. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you're much of a jazz fan at all, I bet you'll recognize this melody. Dizzy Gillespie wrote A Night in Tunisia back in the early 1940s, but there's a style from Tunisia that's a whole lot older, and it's referred to by some as Tunisian jazz, though that's probably a bit misleading. It's called Stambeli, and I've got Fadl Ali Riza on the line from Washington to tell us about it. He's written a lovely piece about Tunisian Stambeli music for Foreign Policy magazine. Fadl, tell us who we're listening to here.
Yeah, so this is a Stambeli troupe. Stambeli was really a sort of musical tradition, but also a set of ceremony and practices that can sort of date back to a history of slaves who had come from sub-Saharan Africa to North Africa, including Tunisia, and had brought with them a lot of their traditions, some of their religious practices, but also their music, which once they arrived in North Africa in sort of the early 1800s, started to mix with some of the practices and religions that are in North Africa. So that's really sort of Islam, but also mystical Islam, sort of a Sufism that you find across Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. So some of that music has stayed on in these communities that you find in Tunisia.
So there is this connection between Stambeli and Islam. And in your article, you mentioned that some conservative Tunisian Muslims strongly oppose Stambeli. Why is that?
Yeah, well, in 2011, you had the Tunisian Revolution. But before that, public displays of religion had been suppressed. And so after that, you had a sort of freedom of religion and freedom of particularly very conservative and orthodox versions of Islam, including what some people may know as Salafism or even strains of Wahhabism that asserted themselves in public life. And they had seen this sort of Islam that Stambeli has, which sort of mixes these sub-Saharan practices and that really date to pagan practices with Sufi Islamic tradition as heterodox, as not part of the dogmatic accepted conservative Islam.
And the headline of your piece says Stambeli is Tunisia's dying jazz. Do you really think it's in danger of dying?
Well, there's a possibility. I mean, it used to be very popular with working-class Tunisians. People would bring Stambeli troops into their houses for these healing ceremonies. And these troops would also have pilgrimages to these shrines of saints that they had revered. But they no longer do that, not only because they're getting smaller for many numerous reasons, such as you know, modern life and modern medicine, but also because working-class Tunisians have sort of adopted some of the conservatism of Salafism and seen these as really being outside the pale of what legitimate Islam is. There's some positive aspects. We see some people trying to really push to revive Stambeli, local NGOs looking at Tunisian arts. And I think some Tunisians who have sort of rejected this new conservative assertion of Islam in public life have turned to Stambeli as sort of a more genuine local tradition that they can try and revive. So it's not all a dark story. I think there's a silver lining as well.
Well, Fadl Ali Riza, a journalist based in Washington, D.C., thank you.
Thank you.
A bit of Tunisian Stambeli music ending the show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Jeb Sharp. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.